asked me a question where they say their name, and it's like...
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the Journal Tribune and the Mainland Media Infrastructure Forum this morning. Thank you for coming out of this whole morning. My name is David Clark, and I am the General Manager for both the Journal Tribune and Mainland Media. We are thrilled that everybody can come this morning for our first business forum. We welcome our Mainland Media readers and our Journal Tribune subscribers. Thank you for joining us. Before the moderator gets the discussion started this morning, I wanted to give a quick thank you to our forum sponsors who made today's event possible. Those sponsors are Club International, Harvard Pilgrim Healthcare, Medic, Main Jobs, and Shuttle Bus Team. And I would also like to extend a special thank you to our host today, People's Choice Credit Union. Thank you to all of these organizations for supporting local journalism. At this time, there's a few people that would like to speak quickly before we get started. And I'd like to introduce Orion Green from Mimic to say a few words, please.
Good morning. How is everybody? We are excited to sponsor this event. We're Mimic is Maine's leading workers' compensation insurer. So new construction to us means new workers and new jobs and safety training. More commercial space means hopefully more workers, which means more insurance and a growing Maine economy and growing businesses. We're also interested in what happens when you have a tight labor market and more businesses are offering more benefits, flexible schedules. How are remote workers affecting safety, transportation, commercial real estate, location, location, location. Saco Biddeford is the location right now, growing tremendously. So I want to thank the Journal Tribune for putting together this awesome panel, and I'm interested to see what these experts have to say. So thank you so much.
Thank you. And I would also like to introduce Peter Fendler from our friends at Hub International.
Good morning, everybody. My name is Peter Fendler. I'm here with my partner, Joe Kilbride. I'm a principal and managing partner at Hub. The logo changed, the screen changed, but we've been doing this for a number of years with Maine Today Media. They've been doing these meetings in the Portland area for a number of years, and it's really nice to see them expanded into the other critical communities in Maine. One of the ones they do every year is on real estate up there, and it's always very interesting to hear the comments. Gary's been part of that panel before. It'll be interesting to see what the feeling is about the Fed's changes to the reductions in the interest rate recently. Hopefully that will have a positive effect on the real estate market. Hub may be a new brand to you. While the brand is new, a lot of the faces are the same. Joe and I have been in the business with our colleagues at both Kilbride and Harris and Norton Insurance and Financial for the last 30 plus years. So those teams remain intact. What we gain by joining Hub is greater market leverage, added assets and resources, all of which help us be better advocates for our clients in the financial services and insurance brokerage space. Hub is the fifth largest financial services and insurance broker in North America. And we're also the fastest growing. So we're here, we're present, we're local, and hopefully we'll be able to work with you at some point in the future. Thank you.
Thank you. With that, I'd like to introduce our moderator for today's discussion on commercial real estate. It's the Portland Press Herald business editor, Carol Colquist.
Thanks, Dave. Thank you. I'm really excited to be here and welcome everyone to our inaugural Business Breakfast Forum here in the Biddeford-Saco area. I'm going to first ask, and are we going to kill this too,
with
strawberry?
Yes.
Thank you.
Just a small cyclone going on.
Yes,
on the top
yes.
Of us. I don't know if you guys can hear it.
So, as Peter mentioned, we've been doing these breakfast forums in the Portland area for about 5 years now, and they've been really interesting. As a journalist, I look at this as another way to explore an issue, a topic that's important to the business community, but to do it in kind of a different fashion. So we have these, we pick a topic that we think is relevant to a particular area, and then we assemble a panel of experts, and we have a conversation, and the idea is for it to be very engaging. Some of you who registered took the opportunity to put questions forward when you registered. We will have a Q&A session at the end of our conversation here. But the idea is if you have a question, please ask it. We think that these work best when the panelists comment on each other's observations and when we get feedback from the audience. So the way we picked this topic today, the roots actually go back to January to the Maine Real Estate and Development Association Forecasting Conference. I consider that my own personal Super Bowl event. I go every year and get a ton of interesting story ideas because all of the presenters are experts in their field and they talk about trends in different categories of commercial real estate. And so it was interesting in January. There was a lot of focus on what was going on in Portland, but the up-and-coming community across many of those presentations was Saco Biddeford. And so in particular, I recall Britt presented for the multifamily sector, and so he had some really interesting data. And that data showed that if you wanted to get into multifamily investments in Portland, you better be ready to lay out north of $500,000. But if you went 15 minutes down the highway, you could invest in a comparable property in Biddeford Saco for about $265,000. And so there was a lot of investment interest that was headed this way. And the, well now, oh, okay, good. Thank you. And then we also had the woman who presented for the retail sector also focused on the Portland area, but she said the place to watch is Route 1 along the Saco-Biddeford corridor. So there's been a lot of interest in this area for a while now. And then about 2 months ago, my colleague in the Press Herald newsroom, Jillian Graham, wrote this story about Biddeford having the youngest median age in the state. And of course, as I'm sure you all know, this is the oldest state in the nation. So what kind of economic development potential does that have when your median age is so significantly different from what the state average is? So to explore all these issues, I assembled this really great panel. So let me introduce them, and then we'll get the ball rolling here. So to my immediate left is Gary Vogel. So Gary is the president of Merida. He's in the middle of a 2-year term, right?
I am.
Yes. And Gary's day job is as a partner at Drummond Woodsum. So he is his practice there is concentrated in real estate and real estate development, financial transactions, commercial transactions, mergers, acquisitions, and commercial law. He also does a lot of work around helping clients explore tax credits that are available to them for different kinds of commercial development. Next to Gary is Britt Vitalius. He is the founder of Vitalius Real Estate Group. He's also a broker there, and he has been working in the multi-unit segment of Maine's economy since 2004. So he has seen all kinds of trends predating the recession and then what's been happening more recently. He's also the head of the Southern Maine Landlord Association, so he understands tenant issues and investment issues from a really specific point of view. He's got fabulous insight there. And then our final panelist this morning is probably someone you know well, and that's Matt Eddy. So he's now the head of economic development in Biddeford, but he's got over 30 years in the planning, economic, and community development field. He has worked at every level of community development, from municipal, state, the private sector, from a regional perspective. I think I met Matt for the first time when he was in Brunswick some years back. So he also brings a terrific perspective to share here. And two other little sort of asides. I had reached out to four different developers who are working on projects in Biddeford Saco, and they were all too busy to contribute, to participate this morning. So that's kind of a good sign. And then the second thing was, yesterday we were doing a breakfast forum in Brunswick, and we were talking about innovations in retail. And one of my panelists is the head of Helm Digital, which is an e-commerce marketing firm. And he has his headquarters in Portland. He recently expanded to Biddeford into one of the mill spaces. And he said, you know what was interesting about that? There's no way, A, I could have found that kind of space in the Portland area. But B, because it was so affordable, I was able to lease a much bigger space than I thought I initially needed. And now I have a photography studio and a video studio, which I wouldn't have had previously. So he was all about, he was going to come this morning, but he too is busy. So anyway, things looks like the table is set for Biddeford Saco right now. And so I'm going to begin with the first question for our panelists. And that is, so what is driving this activity? Is it just a reflection of Portland becoming too expensive, or are there other things at work here? And I'm going to ask Gary to kick that off.
Sure. So thank you, Carol, and thanks for having us. So my perspective is probably, I'm sure, is different from Britt's and from Matt's, which is good, so you'll get to hear from, you know, all of us. And I don't think, to answer Carol's question, I don't think it's really any one thing. I mean, as I talked to a few people about, you know, doing this presentation, first of all, there's different sectors of real estate. So you have industrial has different driving factors than, you know, the apartment market and retail. And in some respects, I think the industrial market is not so community centric. People who are looking for industrial properties, it's proximity to the turnpike, it's the availability of industrial properties probably in the whole southern Maine and greater Portland area. And I think that would have continued. Obviously, cannabis is a big driver there. Mm-hmm. But when you get to retail and multifamily and apartments, you know, my perspective of what's going on in this area is that it really, you know, downtown Biddeford had a ton of vacant mills, which really created the landscape on Main Street. The redevelopment of those mills, which is continuing to go on, was, I think, a big catalyst. And what was the driver behind that? Well, really, the state adopted about, 10 years ago, the state historic tax credit. Mm-hmm. And it really took the combination of both the federal tax credit, which alone wasn't enough, you know, to incentivize developers to do those mill redevelopments, which are very challenging projects and very expensive projects, together with the state historic tax credit, and really getting a few developers who were the early ones to take a lot of risk and move forward. Our office has worked on just about every one of those mill developments, doing the historic tax credit and financing work for most of those projects. And, they've been very successful, but they're, you've got to have someone who's willing to take the leap, on the first of them. I remember working on some of those mill projects long before we had a tax credit. And, you would have developers who would buy them for single digit dollars per square foot, and renting the space out for a couple of bucks per square foot, and hoping that the cash flow, that they could improve them over time with the cash flow. Well, there wasn't enough cash flow to do that, and the kind of work that was required, especially in areas like life safety, where the state fire marshal's office was involved for things like sprinklers and all of the different types of life safety improvements, just those kinds of developments couldn't get done without having, a large, redevelopment. So mills started to get redeveloped. Turns out that it's really cool space. It's affordable space as they're starting to come. And then it brings a lot of small business and a lot of jobs. start coming here, and then, you know, that leads to housing and apartments. Mm-hmm. And so people are, obviously, some people are coming to Biddeford who continue to commute to Portland, but there's a lot of growth of the, you know, the small business sector, which is also bringing jobs, requires housing, and I think all of those things have, you know, have really contributed to kind of a all of the above mm-hmm. set of factors that makes these, you know, communities, you know, work well. I mean, this, the same thing's going on in, you know, in Westbrook for a lot of the same reasons. It's a little closer to Portland, but there's a lot of opportunity for development there. So I'll let the others comment as well.
Britt, what's driving this activity?
That's really interesting to hear the perspective of the mills and how that opened up, because when the thing I've been observing for a while is when Pepperell Mill did the lofts, which I think was around 10 years ago, as far as I know, there was no real model for those units. There was no comp that you could go to say you should build these high-end lofts and there's a market there. And so to some degree, there was a market there the whole time and no one developed them until the mills were able to be developed and the developer took the risk and built them out and sort of discovered a market. So I think that's just an interesting piece to note that maybe it's been around for a while. I think there's several trends that are going on right now, and it is complicated. I think generally urbanization is a trend nationally, and we're seeing it. We're seeing it drive prices and demand in many urban centers around the country, and it's true in Saco and Biddeford, just as we're experiencing it in Portland. People want to move to the cities, and that was not the case 20 years ago. So there's just a different pressure and demand on these urban centers than there used to be. We're seeing in Portland, there's a lot of investment interest, and there's a lot of capital for investment. And Portland, we can talk about Portland more because it's related, is the prices are crazy, and they're kind of through the roof, and it's hard for renters, it's hard for investors to get a return, and so they're looking for alternatives, and they're being driven out to the Saco and Biddefords and Brunswick's and Westbrook's, and that's great. And so there are now tenants in these centers, and there are investors looking for opportunities, and so they're all sort of converging. And I think the mills have created capacity. In Portland, there's nowhere to build. We are not really creating new inventory in Portland. For all the demand for new housing, for affordable housing, there is virtually none being created in the downtown. There might be a building, but it's 30 units, maybe even it's 100 units, but nothing that's going to be a game changer. The units are all being added outside of the center in Scarborough and South Portland, and these mills have created an opportunity to add residential units, add business space in an urban center. So I think there's just a nice convergence of a lot of different dynamics happening down here, and it's really exciting.
Great. Matt, is this all just because of your fabulous work here in the cities? Is that it?
No, I'm here because I saw it coming. It makes me look good. I think taking a step back, we had a vote on our parking garage and it was approved on Tuesday night. But creating the dynamics with which all that happened started back in the early 2000s when a predecessor, Bob Dodge, some of you may remember Bob, in Biddeford, established a TIF that started pumping money into the downtown. That's how we bought Merck, and that's how we took Merck out. And that in our community, that's still a very, very hyper conversation that people have very strong opinions on both sides. But if you think about what's going on in Portland and Portsmouth, and you think about what happened in the Gold Coast from the North End to Rockland over the last 20 years, we were just a black hole for a time, and now all of a sudden, we've solved. You know, when Jim Bennett and I were in Westbrook, we used to talk about, well, it doesn't smell anymore. Well, it's the same damn thing here. It doesn't smell anymore. It's a very simple concept. And then having all these unique structures, the mill facilities, the land. There's still a lot more land associated with it. Creates all sorts of opportunity at a time when the region needs some of this diversity to fill the hole. So I like to think about it being a series of decisions that some pretty courageous policymakers took on a local level to get us to this point.
Interesting. So, Britt, I'm going to ask the next question of you. Can you talk a little bit about what the difference in terms of the cost to entry here in Biddeford versus in Portland? You said that you're getting a lot of investor interest, and I'm wondering, who are those investors? Are they out of state? Are they in state? What are they looking for? How do the returns compare?
Right now, it's been a hot real estate market for a long time, which makes us all very nervous. because suddenly everybody, not suddenly, now everyone is an investor, from your dentist to, you know, some young folks from out of state, and they're all trying to get in the game and put their money in real estate. So a lot of young people are local, but there's some out of state money buying some of these buildings. And that's sort of what's on the ground with the smaller units in both Portland and Saco and Biddeford. And we're listing two units up in Portland for over $500,000, buildings that should be owner-occupied, that were designed to be owner-occupied, and the highest offers are coming from investors for two units, over $500,000. I don't understand it, but that's what's going on. And so people who don't want to be paying that much for a two-unit are saying, well, what else is there? And they're coming down to Saco and Biddeford and finding more reasonable pricing and the opportunity to make some returns down here. It's also the case that Portland developers, there's not much, there's a lot of reasons they are frustrated by Portland. Maybe I'll leave it there for now. and are coming down here. So Port Properties and Bob Goudreau and Jim Brady and others are now playing in this market and finding opportunities and are pleasantly surprised with how welcoming a community can be, at least from what I'm hearing anecdotally from them, and for the opportunities. And so there's real local knowledge and skills on the development side. They're coming down here and doing things well, in addition to sort of the more entry-level investor market coming down here. And there's a lot of legacy properties. You know, this was a mill town for a long time, and a lot of the existing structures, you know, there's really two markets. There's the mill market and a lot of the new development. There's a lot of just the smaller workforce housing that still exists, and a lot of it's still tired. And so both things are happening, and the professional developers are coming in and working primarily in the mill area with the historic buildings, and the entry-level investors are coming in and buying twos and threes and sixes and finding the opportunity to improve those units that in many cases have been neglected for a long time, and are finally getting some attention. And this is a trend that's been happening in Portland for a lot of years now, which has really improved the housing stock, has also created some challenges around the affordability in Portland, because these properties are more affordable when they're owned by somebody who's had them for 20 or 30 years and has not done very much to them. The rents tend not to move. When you get new investment excitement and capital in a building, they want a return on their investment. They also don't want to own the building the way it's been run for 30 years. They want to make it nicer, but that creates changes.
Mm-hmm. And how about the returns? Are they comparable?
The returns are higher out of the gate by maybe a point or two, you know, where we're kind of settled into a 7 cap. In Portland, maybe you're at 8, 9 down here is I think what we're hearing, but there's also the opportunity to bring something to the table. And what we find is investors rarely want to just buy a building and run it as it is and take their sort of modest return. They want to bring something, be active, and increase the return, and there's still opportunity to do that down here.
Hmm. Gary, what are you seeing from the investment side?
I would agree with, you know, with a lot of what Britt has said. I mean, certainly, you know, development in Portland is challenging. And the city has done a lot of things that, you know, continues to make it more difficult, whether it's we're talking about historic districts or various different types of fees and cost structures that developers have to, you know, have to endure. And even the process, mm-hmm. you know, of getting a project through the planning board. So You know, I can't tell you how many times I hear people say, you know, this is the last project I'm going to do in Portland. Usually, after a while, they find another opportunity that they can't really, you know, turn away from. But you know, in just, again, as in comparison, you know, in the Portland market, you know, all of the easy sites have been developed, all of the low-hanging fruit mm-hmm. in terms of the, you know, rehab projects have pretty much been done. And so the stuff that's being done is very challenging in many respects. You know, I'm working on a lot of those, and there a lot of times there are some, you know, really interesting projects. But when you come down into, you know, into this market, and I think, again, the same thing is true for other communities like Westbrook and Brunswick, there are certainly opportunities, mm-hmm. and we're seeing developers who are, you know, excited about finding opportunities to invest in. The, you know, the lending market is very competitive. You know, one of the things that's affecting real estate development everywhere is construction costs,
yep.
And you know, and that's challenging. But when you are, you know, when you're working with a project that's already very marginal in terms of its return in, say, in the Portland market, you know, coming here gives you a little more flexibility in terms of what you can afford when you're, you know, at the sort of, 10-yard line of being ready to commence construction. You find out that, guess what, your construction costs are, you know, are 10 or 15 or 20% higher than what you were budgeting for. You know, you may still be able to make that work. Obviously, one of the things that's helped throughout the, you know, the state in terms of construction costs has been, you know, the low interest rate environment has really saved a lot of projects that would otherwise probably have had to just be shelved,
mm-hmm.
Because the fact is that you could afford more debt, you know, with the interest rate environment that we've been fortunate to have.
Do you think that, as Peter mentioned, that the reduction by the Fed of interest rates by a quarter of a point will have an immediate impact on that? Or do you think the ball's already rolling and this is just going to let it go a little farther?
So the real estate market tends to be driven not so much by the Fed interest rate, but by the 10-year Treasury rate, which is a market set.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a market rate. And, you know, as you may have heard about the inverted yield curve, mm-hmm. I mean, we've had really low long-term rates, you know, for a long time. And, you know, in some respects, I think the Fed's, or at least one of the drivers behind the Fed's action, I think, is to try to bring the yield curve more into balance.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure whether that's going to happen or not. They don't have control over really what happens on the, you know, with respect to the 10-year Treasury rates. But so the mortgage market really isn't driven by those, you know, the Fed rate. And but obviously lowering of rates on the, you know, on the Fed rate, you know, continues a lower rate environment, which
mm-hmm.
you know, which does have some impact upon the Treasury rate.
Mm-hmm.
I would say the part that's relevant is just the economy generally.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're playing with the Fed rate to try and keep the economy
right.
going the way it's
yep.
been going. And the question, I think, for this area and these other the other markets here is, can we withstand a downturn? Because in 08, you know, prior to 08, there was a lot of attention down in Saco and Biddeford, and there was a lot of investment, and it was obvious that this was the next place to be.
Mm-hmm.
And the number of times I heard people say, oh, it's between Portland and Boston, and what's not to love, and it's near the water and the river. And after 08, it just went into a hole for some years, and it was slow coming out. And Portland didn't hit that same level of sort of transactional stagnation, at least, that things were still moving in Portland. It was slower, for sure, but the market was healthier than Saco and Biddeford and Lewiston Auburn, which really just got stuck for a while, at least from as a broker's perspective,
mm-hmm.
with transactions. And so the question in my mind is, if we have a downturn, are these communities more hardened? Are there just enough businesses here and enough jobs, and they've kind of become enough of their own center of gravity to withstand that?
Mm-hmm.
I think that's what we'll keep an eye on.
Okay. Matt, tell us about the investors who knock on your door. Are there any similarities or trends that you're seeing?
I think the more interesting thing is we're seeing a lot of small investors who are relocating for one reason or another, and they're coming into the area. We established a housing inspection program about 4 years ago now, and we went through and inspected every structure that was three units or more. And we identified a series of issues that were associated with those structures. We did 660 unit structures, 37 right now are in compliance, so that means there's a lot of room for reinvestment in a lot of what we consider to be older structures in the community.
I'm sorry, would you say that number again?
I would be glad to. Yeah. 37 of the 660 units are now certified as being safe.
Wow.
Which means we have a lot more work to do. But it's created an environment in which people can come in and invest. And then at the same time, we're trying to create an environment as a community for people to come in and work with us. We've put in a series of density bonuses based on the size of the building, not the size of the lot. We've put together some investment structures so that we can encourage first-time home buyers to come into that 2 to 4 unit. A lot of our small investors are buying these 3 and 4 and 5 unit structures and putting good investment into them. But we're also seeing the port properties. John Liberty's hiding back there a little bit, but you know, they took on a major structure in the downtown. Good example of a unit that because of the structural economy had been held well under the economy, their rental rates were well under, and the condition of those units were substantially poor. And so we're beginning to see investors and a lot of good local contractor owner types coming in and doing really sound investment, and they're attracting a younger population. You know, we're definitely the home to a lot of UNE graduates that are staying in the area, but we're also beginning to see a lot of folks, younger folks from the Portland area come down. And we're seeing this, we were talking about earlier, we're seeing this weird, that I haven't really been able to explain, introduction of people from Brooklyn, New York, who are coming up as investors and people that are buying houses and buying businesses and creating a lot of new investment opportunities themselves. So it's a different picture, and I think a lot of it has to do with just what we have structurally underneath and the fact that there's plenty of opportunity to buy at an affordable price and to make improvements that bring it up to a decent quality of living that's not real expensive. And that's a different way of walking into what you said. You know, that's what we're seeing coming in the door.
So with all this interest in, particularly in the multifamily arena, are you seeing a big difference in rents in the area? Because back in January, during the Merida forecast that Britt did, roughly $200 a month was the difference between a one-bedroom in Portland and a one-bedroom in Biddeford. Is that holding, or is that gap closing because there's so much investment interest and people are upgrading apartments and multifamilies here? Anybody?
let me start at least because I think I'd want to hear what Britt has to say from a statistical perspective. You know, what we're feeling, what we're seeing is, you know, what the run-of-the-mill, the studio apartments started out with rental rates at $700 or $800. I think they're opening up at $900 to $1,000 now, and they hadn't come on the market yet. Mm-hmm. So that's the kind of stress we're seeing. You know, we've very clearly done some analysis for council, telling them that, you know, we're excited about this investment, but there's also a need to begin to preserve a certain number of units for affordability purposes, because we also have this mill complex which has jobs and employers looking for people to work there. And so we need to try to figure out how to, as we're going through this renaissance, also maintain an affordability across all different income groups. And so there certainly is, we're certainly seeing a pressure on rents,
mm-hmm.
and we think it's a good thing, and we just need to figure out what that balance is. But the, we're also seeing a tremendous investment in older units who are literally 20 or 30 years behind the curve. So,
what do you see, Britt?
What I'm seeing is a range from rates that are comparable to Portland today in some of the new mill units where there are one bedrooms for $1,400 is similar to a Portland rate. And units in more of the legacy buildings that probably is a little behind the curve and is starting to increase. So there's still a gap between Portland and the Saco and Biddeford area of probably a couple hundred dollars per unit. But it's been interesting to hear some anecdotes where an owner will buy a building and before they even make changes, they can, the tenants who had been sitting at 700 could accept an increase to 800 even before the building's improved. That's interesting. Is it scary or is it actually that when you have owners who have owned for so long that they actually are not, they don't know the market rate. And so on the ground, rents are going up, but what we're discovering is that the market rate was actually higher. That same tenant would have actually paid mm-hmm. $100 more for that same unit. We just didn't know it. But it still creates stress in the community, so I'm not mm-hmm. minimizing the impact and that therefore rates are going up, but it's just a strange dynamic when more active investors suddenly come into a market and start testing, wait, where is the market actually? Because maybe we don't know, and maybe we've actually all been under market, but that has been the norm. So that's a strange dynamic. The other piece that starts to happen, and really happened in Portland, is the units are just nicer. And so is the market rent going up? Well, kind of. Maybe we're discovering that the market rent was higher, but also the units are just nicer. And so it's not an A to A anymore, it's a A to B comparison. And we're discovering that there are tenants who will pay more rent for a nicer unit. And that's what happened in Portland, and I think we're seeing that here. And the gap's hard to figure, and I haven't done enough deep research to figure it out, because even in Portland, the average rent, there's such a split in grading of units mm-hmm. now, where there are one bedrooms for $1,100 in Portland, and there are one bedrooms for $2,200, and probably one bedrooms for $3,000 a month in Portland. So the average is getting harder and harder to calculate, and we'll either hire someone or I'll figure out how to open up some time in my schedule to do a more broken out analysis of the rental market. I think we're starting to see that differentiation down here too.
So I'm just curious, so how do you test that market? Does, for instance, is perhaps you have a new unit in one of the mills, it's brand new and it's developed, and you test it by saying, okay, $1,400 a month for the one bedroom, and suddenly you get a zillion offers, and okay, we're going to try $1,500. I mean, how do you do that? How do you test that?
Yeah, well, I think like Matt was just saying.
The waiting lists for, you know, more of the subsidized units are substantial. I mean, I've never seen a community with longer waiting lists. It goes 6 or 7 years into the future.
Hmm.
I think that speaks a little bit to, I mean, that's one thing we can look at and say, oh, okay, that's real.
And for the developers, when they've got a number of units, what they're going to do is they've got a lot of units to absorb. So they're going to start testing. And if those go quickly, they'll raise the rates a bit. Mm-hmm. And they're trying to find that balance, not fill them too fast. But they can sort of feel the market response.
I mean, a good example on a market side was Doug Sanford's 50 units that he just put on the market. I think they started advertising, Danica, correct me, was it April or May? And he's full. You know, he opened officially just after the 4th of July, and they're built out, they're done. And so we know that there's an existing market for that higher end unit.
Yeah. I mean, what I can say that, you know, as far as affordable housing development, I do a lot of work, you know, in that community with Maine Housing, and the fact that we're having higher rents actually is obviously it's challenging for the affordability of the existing housing stock, but it does create an opportunity for development. So for those of you who aren't exactly familiar with what's going on, in terms of affordable housing development, you know, we have there's really two programs that we've got in the state, and one is the 9%, these are federal programs, the 9% low-income housing tax credit program, and that's a competitive program, and literally only 6 or 7 new projects get developed each year under that program. About 20 apply for the tax credits, but it's a competitive scoring program that Maine Housing does, and based upon the scoring, the number of credits that the state gets from the federal government enables us to do about 6 or 7 projects each year. But there's also a 4% low-income housing tax credit program, which is unlimited. And there, so there isn't a what we call a state ceiling on that. And the state can develop more and provide more of those 4% credits. Harder to do those projects because literally there's less than half the tax credit available, so there typically has to be some other subsidy that goes along with it. What we're finding is the 4% projects are working well in Portland and Westbrook because the rent structure is that Maine Housing doesn't have to provide a ton of subsidy to make the projects work because the projects can be affordable to someone who's the maximum is 60% of area median income. So those projects can be affordable to someone who is at 60% of area median income without having to provide a ton of subsidy, and therefore we can do more of those projects. And I think that's going to be the case here in this market as well, that you're going to be able to see the development of more affordable housing projects using the 4% tax credit without having to, you know, have sort of a limited supply of how much, you know, state subsidy Maine Housing has to provide towards those projects.
Can you speak a little bit about the affordability? If you want to develop housing in Portland, you need to put a certain amount of money aside for affordable housing if your project is a market rate or a luxury project?
Actually, it's not based, it's not whether your project is a luxury or a market rate project. It's really based upon the number of units.
Right.
So if in Portland adopted a inclusionary zoning, which requires that for developers of 10 or more units, they have to make one unit affordable to someone who is at, I believe it's at 100% of area median income.
Right.
And that's whether it's a rental or a for sale project. So in the rental market, usually, again, given the rents and the fact that we're dealing with 100% of area median income, in the rental market, usually between the size of the units and, a developer can create a rental unit that is, unless it's a really luxury project, they can create a rental units, 10% of their rental units that do that. Developers can also opt out by paying $100,000 per unit to the Housing Trust Fund, and for the luxury projects or condominium projects, typically that's what's done. Also, if you develop a 15-unit building, when we started out, it was sort of, we had these tiers. If you had 10 units to 19 units, you had to do one, and once you hit 20, you had to do two units. Now, you've got to, if you do a 15-unit building, you've got to do one, but you also have to pay 50% to the Housing Trust Fund for the essentially the half unit that's available, and inclusionary zoning is a controversial subject because of the fact that to the extent that you create too many requirements and make it too expensive for developers, it's obviously going to have an impact upon reducing the supply, mm-hmm. and ultimately, you know, whatever you do in terms of, you know, housing affordability, nothing has a bigger impact than supply and demand, mm-hmm. And so to the extent that you're, you know, lowering the supply, it's probably going to have more of an impact upon, you know, the rental market than if you are not, you know, messing around with those sorts of things. So it's an area that you have to be very sensitive to. I mean, I think it's kind of like a Goldilocks thing, you know, a little bit, you know, and if you get it just right, you know, you continue to create and develop housing and you're creating, 10% housing affordability. If you do too much, you can reduce the supply, and it can have the opposite effect, you know, upon housing affordability. I will say in Portland, there is, you know, a fair amount of money going into the housing trust fund. The city hasn't really done much with that, but I think you're going to see the city trying to incentivize some developers using those funds as well, which will be helpful. And I know Marita was very engaged in that when Portland did it, because we looked at it as something that we thought would be, you know, a model throughout the state. And I think as housing affordability becomes an issue in other communities, you know, naturally people are going to take a look at what they did in Portland and, you know, maybe adopt that in some other communities. I know some of those discussions are going on. So,
do you know if any other communities have adopted it?
I can say we haven't adopted it, but we used it. The River Dam project, we basically borrowed the Portland model and made 10% of those units affordable at 100% median. As part of the negotiation process for the TIFs,
sure,
the development exchange. And that seemed like a really good way to do it. We didn't have to get into an ordinance discussion. Certainly they're talking about it in our comprehensive plan update, and we may do something like that. I suspect we will. But that was a very friendly negotiation to get the project to where we needed to get it. So it was a great model to use.
I frankly think that's the best way that you can do that, to create those incentives. So whether it's, you know, density bonuses that require that there be a certain amount of affordability, or TIFs or other sort of incentives, and have a negotiation with the developer, because ultimately, you know, the project and the numbers have to work. If you create a structure that just doesn't work, you know, and then ultimately what you're finding is you know, the projects like the River Dam Mill, I mean, the pre-development period, you know, for working on that, you've got to have a developer who's willing to essentially start working and spending money on, you know, on soft costs, land acquisition, you know, maybe for 2 or 3 years, as, you know, before the development goes in, and taking a real risk. And now they're, you know, now they're finally getting to the point where they're going out to bid and finding the construction costs are 15 or 20% higher. You know, how does that all work? Well, yeah, maybe you can raise the rents in order to do that, but, you know, you're not going to be able to raise the rents with respect to the affordable projects, or at least they have to remain affordable to, you know, people who are at 100% of area median income, and some may be targeted to less than 100% of area median income. And that may be, again, that may be good and appropriate if, you know, if it's not too much and the projects can work.
The first time I read about Portland's inclusionary zone, I thought there was an extra zero in the opt-out amount. It's like $100,000 per unit? Wow. So
I believe I heard that Nick Mavadonis threw that number out at the last minute, thinking it was so high that no one would ever pay it.
Oh,
and so
really?
The idea was to get the units, not to actually have anyone actually pay. Don't quote me.
These are my notes.
I wasn't at the city council meeting, although it's probably on record.
I thought
somewhere.
I heard him say off the record. All
right. But I think what they're learning is that the dollars actually, the dollars are more helpful to getting units built. And I'm not a developer, but certainly talked to enough that, you know, in my contention through that was, okay, you get one more unit. Somebody builds 10, you get one more unit. This is not moving the needle.
Mm-hmm.
We need to think bigger than this. And as you talk to developers who want to build affordable housing, they would be thrilled to build affordable housing. They need TIFs. There's just no way to bridge the gap. And so I think the model of what you did in the TIFs, combining with the inclusionary, it worked for everyone. I mean, they want to build the units, they want to build right. them that way, but they need the help. So I think Portland just lost our city planner. I don't know what your...
No, thank you. Pretty happy. I think what's interesting in that process, though, is it really takes an open book negotiated process. I mean, even as we went through that and we knew that there was a financial deal that had to be struck, and that the city was going to have to do certain things and continue to do certain things, River Dam is an example, we needed to make sure the city council understood what we were doing and the details of what that finance. They had to understand what the bottom line was and why we were working with the developer to reach it. And in turn, the developer had to trust us that we were going to work in their best interest to protect what we thought was a good investment structure. And we're small, we don't have the complications of Portland. We're small enough that we can do that on a case-by-case basis. And I think that will serve us well as we move forward.
So actually, that's a good lead-in, Matt, to the last question I have for this before we open it up to questions from the audience. We keep hearing the development here in Biddeford Saco in the context of what's going on in Portland. And Britt mentioned there could be a critical mass of Biddeford Saco investment. It's independent of what's going on with Portland. So has it reached that? I mean, is Biddeford Saco always going to be considered, well, I can't afford Portland, I'm going to look at Biddeford Saco? Is there an opportunity, or has Biddeford Saco investment reached a critical mass where it can stand on its own and it doesn't need the spillover from Portland?
Well, you know, we're a micropolitan of Portland. Mm-hmm. I mean, you don't ignore that mm-hmm. fact. What goes on in Portland, frankly, affects a much larger part of the state of Maine than just us. Mm-hmm. But I think we do have an influence from Boston. We are seeing a lot of commuting trends of people that are living in Biddeford and commuting to Boston for two or three times a week. We are seeing in the smaller investors, we're really seeing as folks that are coming up from the south, not necessarily from Portland down. The larger investors, you know, when you start getting into five or six units more, we're seeing those being more Portland-based or certainly the greater Portland region-based kind of investors. I have to tell you, I keep hearing the stories of folks that I'm not, you know, I'm no expert in the internet, and I don't understand how it happens. But when all of a sudden our byline or our contact ends up in the New Yorker, and we didn't put it there, we're kind of curious about how that word of mouth thing is going. And so we're really seeing a very diverse group coming up and showing an interest.
It's all those Brooklyn kids buying units, right?
Yes. I think the other thing, to be honest, and it's a cultural change that's going on, but, you know, I think probably 20 years ago, Biddeford Pool and the wealthy part of Biddeford was looking to divest itself of the community. And that didn't happen. And now with the investment that's going on, with the investment going into the city theater and some of the nonprofits, we're seeing a lot more attention from that population group. And I think that also brings new investors from those families into the community, and we're seeing a bit of that too.
Anyone else?
I don't know. I don't know this market as well, and although I speak at a forecast conference every year, I usually spend the next year apologizing for whatever I said was going
to
happen.
I have to say, when Britt does his forecast, he always looks at what he said the year before, and he grades himself on whether he got his predictions right. So you're very accountable.
I don't think I would graduate with the grades I got each year. But I think there's been enough infrastructure improvement. You know, I think a lot of these historic mill towns have to go through this transition to figure out what they're going to be next. And I think that's finally happening, and that's got to be really help for it to, you know, this community to stand on its own, that there are real jobs. Those spaces are being used. There are nice mm-hmm. residences there. There are businesses there. So there's an economy that's happening here, and I think that's really positive. The young folks seems to be a very true trend. I got stats from one of the mill developments, and 50% of the occupants are in their 20s. So that young
here thing, in Biddeford Saco?
Yes.
Wow.
So that seems to be real, but I don't know if that's a vulnerability or if that's if there's a downturn because they're not attached to this area, they're going to get married and go to the burbs or go wherever they're going to go next. And so I guess it makes me curious if there gets to be the next level of investment in the form of condos and ownership here mm-hmm. in the community, so it doesn't mm-hmm. Right now we've got the vibrancy, but it's still potentially transient. People don't have to stay. That would be a next thing to watch for.
And that's a concern for us, is the you know, we have always been a very transient community, and part of all of this, even though we're having all these market rates coming on, is the goal of creating more ownership. We'd like to see more condo development. And we're certainly trying to provide pathways in which owners can get into the two and four unit structures and create stability in those neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. I mean, that is a strategy that we're actively pursuing.
You know, one of the things in Portland, I don't think, you know, we're seeing a lot of 20-somethings move into, you know, the urban areas because they can't afford it.
Right.
And there's a lot of drivers behind that. I mean, one of them, obviously, we haven't talked about is the whole Airbnb thing. And I don't know to what extent the, you know, Airbnb market is a factor here in Saco and Biddeford. In Portland, it is a big factor, and it's taking a lot of rental units, you know, off the market. The other thing that I hear from talking to people, just sort of anecdotally, is like, well, who are the people who are buying and moving into, you know, our neighborhoods? And, you know, many of them either come with their own job,
and they're working
remotely. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, we had, my wife owns a condo in, you know, on Munjoy Hill, and the rents are, I think, crazy. And but when, you know, when we put an ad in the paper, we don't get flooded with calls.
Wait, you put an ad in the paper?
No, we don't put an ad in the paper.
We
do what everybody else does. You know. But you know,
you post it online at Main Jobs, right?
Exactly. When we put an ad out there, you know, we don't get flooded, but we get four or five really good ones. You know, some of them are working remotely, and they're bringing their job from, you know, from New York, and they're continuing to do it. Or, you know, or they are, you know, professionals, and they have, you know, really, really substantial incomes, you know, and they're able to afford that. But so for, you know, for 20-somethings who don't have that, or who may have a ton of student debt, you know, there certainly are opportunities in, you know, in other communities. And to the extent you can find, you know, a job and work in Saco and Biddeford and not be commuting, you know, 45 minutes into Portland, I think that's really desirable as well.
Thank you. Those are all great observations. Okay, your turn. Do you have questions, folks in the audience? Yes, right here.
This question may be more for Matt, but I was just sort of wondering if you could help me understand sort of the Main Street commercial retail situation. I understand all this interest in the area. I also walk down the street and see a lot of vacancies, and I was wondering if you could just sort of explain that situation.
Yes, they're less than they used to be.
Yep.
And that's really the sum of what's going on now. The units that are vacant have issues. They're structural issues, they're ownership issues. The ones that are beginning to fill up are ones that have gone through a change. And that's fun to watch. I think, you know, for someone who's watched Biddeford for a long time, now is in it, and I walk Main Street and I try to walk the downtown every day, the kind of activity that's on Main Street is different. On the other hand, you know, we're very cautious. You know, we believe we've got that we can also get into the food industry, the food cluster, and the foodie movement pretty easily, and we're really moving hard in that direction. But we like to see retail, but we also want to see those retailers being savvy enough to understand the new market that they're working in. That if they aren't internet savvy and they don't work through a homepage, then I'm not even sure I want to talk to them and work with them. So when they do come in the office, the first thing we ask is, what is your business plan, and have you identified your market? Show me. And that's a great first conversation to have, because then we know they're real. If they are real, we'll work real hard to get them there. But there's some structural issues still remaining in the downtown that have to do with old owners that have made a fair living without putting any money into those units. And we are already seeing that turnover. We're already seeing vacancies turn up. We're not seeing the turnover. We're seeing the new businesses being careful, starting up slow, and doing well. And I think we'll see that trend continue.
That was my question to a developer I sat with this week in preparation for this, and they made the point about there are some legacy owners of those buildings that are not selling. So those buildings are not getting the investment, and they're just going to keep being what they are until they transition. And so there's a little bit of a new mill culture, because that's where everything's new and happening, businesses and restaurants and breweries and all that. And it can only get into the downtown so much, insofar as there's investment in the downtown. And you're not going to make people sell or make them put money into the property. So
is there a reason why they won't sell? Is it like the price isn't where they want, or they're just they're just old curmudgeon-y Yankees? Okay.
That's a nice way to describe them. That's a very nice way to describe them. But they've been cash cows for a long time. They bought them for song.
Mm-hmm.
They're sitting on them. They have a revenue flow. They're going to want a very high return on that sale. And almost every one of them that we've talked about, in some way the community's going to have to be involved to make it happen.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, they often tell me, stop talking about my building. And I say, okay, I won't name you by name. But when someone walks into my office, I'll point to the buildings that I want people to go look at.
Some of that is also that when you get an older owner and they've owned a building forever and it's going to be all gain when
right.
they sell it,
right.
you know, and they know that if they pass it on to their heirs, they're going to get a step up in basis and avoid all of that capital gain. You know, many owners in that situation are going to say, look, I'm just going to continue to own it. I'll pass it on to my heirs, and then I will, you know, let them sell it, and they can avoid having to pay the gain on it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, because you can do a 1031 exchange,
mm-hmm.
but then you have to find a new property. And many of those owners who are, you know, who are elderly really don't have the wherewithal or the energy
mm-hmm.
from which to go out and, you know, do a new development.
I think for these owners that I think have good hearts and really want to do something good in the community, I think that's exactly where they are. And so we just try to work with them to have them hold on until they're ready to do something a little bit different. I mean, I've had the conversation about, well, I have my 16-year-old and he might want to be in my real estate business.
Right there.
Yes. How has the University of New England, with the state's only medical school, which is based in Bedford, figured into all of these improvements that you're talking about?
The impact of UNE.
Well, lots of different ways. First of all, the UNE is a tremendous partner. I'm not sure that was always historically true in the community, but I believe it really is now. We work with them on a regular basis. They have different investment strategies. We would like to get different aspects of them in the downtown. But, you know, the Saxon Development Group, which is now looking pretty hard all over the state and is located in other areas, they're pretty far along in their review process. And part of that is the fact that they've got a combination of Southern Maine Med and UNE students that need to be here for odd times. And they need to bring in researchers for odd times. So they have a very different kind of lease situation that they're offering up that I think fits the UNE description. You know, on a very localized personal level, you know, the freshman class now comes into the community every September. It's been going on for 2 years. We're building that relationship with the students that never was there before. You know, I think I heard a story told at one point just a few years ago, speaking to our vacancies and what they looked like, of, no, this is the Biddeford downtown and we don't want you to go there. That's changed, that's flipped. And it's a very different story now, and there's just a host of different relationships that we're working on that I think will all ultimately pay off in more activity of UNE in the community.
Just to follow up to that, is it true that the University of New England has grown so rapidly that they haven't been able to house a good chunk of their classes on campus because they haven't been able to keep up with the dorm space, and so that's providing a driver for apartment growth?
Yes. Okay. Yes, they're nervous. I think it's fair to say, I don't think I'm speaking out of turn, they're nervous. They think it's a positive trend, but they need to see it for another year. Before they really make their next step of investment. They have space in their master plan for one more dorm on the Biddeford campus. And at that point, we really need to look at other options.
Other questions? Right here, Orion.
You mentioned downturn, stalling growth back in 2008. Is there anybody in a strong enough position that then they can take advantage of the downturn and continue investment construction costs go down, and that's potentially actually a great opportunity to make investments and keep growth happening, knowing that it's going to bounce back if there's a short downturn.
That's a great question, and that's sort of exactly the dynamics I've been talking about for the last year or two. Is right now it's been hard for us to build, I mean, at least in the Portland area, to build our way out of sort of housing shortage because construction costs are so high. So we're a little stuck here. The market's so good, and yet the construction costs just still aren't, don't make it feasible to build more housing. And so a little bit of cooling, I think, could be a healthy thing. And so we don't want to wait, but a little bit of cooling and kind of rebalancing would be positive.
There's certainly a number of investors and developers that are sitting on the sidelines who have said, you know, I can't find anything in this market, probably referring more to, you know, to Portland, but that the price structure and the returns just aren't there, and they're really waiting for, you know, the next downturn to be able to find some opportunities.
But I've been telling people not to buy on Monjoy Hill for several years, and all the people who didn't listen to me have properties that are worth a lot more money than they were a few years ago. So.
Yeah.
See, he's very accountable. Very accountable.
It's just the way this has gone for so long, and having come out of 08, which was, you know, pretty scarring, you just couldn't see. And so, but we're, I think those of us who are in the industry are sort of braced at any moment it could change.
So let me slide in a question from one of our registrants, and that is, I think it's directed at you, Matt. What is the status of the Saco Lowell Mill building?
That's a building owned by Art Gerard, and Art is in the process right now of white boxing it. And in fact, I met with Art and his wife, Fran. Fran is also on the board at UNE. And they were showing me window samples and paneling samples for finishing off the inside. It's his intent to rehab that building and then see what comes. We did put in an application into EDA for a research and development facility at that site. We did not get it. We were disappointed in that, but we're continuing to work down that arm with UNE. To do something like that, and that building would be ideal.
Cool. I think we have time for one more question.
At a recent real estate forum up in Portland, there was a conversation that there's more capacity for hotels up in Portland. And having said that, Mayor Strimling had suggested a fee or a tax per room on developers coming in. And that money would go into, maybe it's the housing fund, to create some more affordable housing in Portland. Is that still on the table?
So they, my understanding is the city did, they rolled back some of what they were proposing, especially, and I know Marita got involved in this, they were looking at some projects that had already been permitted. And, you know, from our perspective for development, if you've got a project and you've already got your permits and approvals and you've got your financing lined up, and all of a sudden, you know, you add what could be several hundred thousand dollars worth of fees and costs to it, and all of a sudden your pro forma, you know, no longer works. And so I think various developers and others who, you know, lobbied the city were able to get them to sort of back off on the implementation of that. But my understanding is that the city did adopt a substantial impact fee, and it does include a cost per room for hotels. And I believe those funds are going into the, you know, housing trust fund.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to, you know, as Britt said, the funds in that housing trust fund are growing, and it should enable, you know, the city to essentially sponsor, whether it's through a competition with, you know, other developers, you know, to create, you know, several hundred units of housing. And obviously, you know, if you're a hotel operator, finding staff who can work you know, at the hotel and afford to live in the community or even somewhere where they can commute from, you know, is an issue. I still think it goes back to the same kind of Goldilocks thing. I mean, I think you can do it to a certain extent. When you do it, if it becomes too prohibitive, then, you know, at some point you're going to see projects not get built as a result of it. So I do think it's a very careful balancing. Fortunately, the growth in, you know, there's a lot of hotels still on the docket to be built, and so it doesn't seem to have enough of an impact to turn away projects. You know, some of that is still kind of yet to be seen.
So before thanking our panelists for being here today, let me thank you all for showing up. We want to make this a regular occurrence. If you have ideas for business topics that you'd like us to explore at these business forums, please let me know. You can find me at ccoltis@pressherald.com. And the other thing is, as you leave, please remember not to use your cell phone while you're driving. I saw three people pulled over on the way down here, and we heard through the grapevine that the police are going to be out in full force. So be safe and don't hold your cell phone as you drive.
Today is the day.
So now will you please join me in thanking our panelists.
They're open to a million different things, or maybe you've got somebody else you've talked to.
We're
trying to be very careful.
Getting emails like motivated.
Well, you know, like all real estate, location. I mean, I think to the extent that the community develops as more investment, more